From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
If you were Putin right now, you would say, hey, we're back to the old games with the United States. There's no way Trump can ever do a deal with us.
That was President Donald Trump Thursday responding to a reporter's question at a press conference about a Russian vessel that has been off the east coast of the United States.
You have to understand, if I was just brutal on Russia right now, just brutal, people would say, you would say, oh, isn't that wonderful? But I know you well enough. Then you would say, oh, he was too tough. He shouldn't have done that. Look,
I'm just
all
trying
of
to find
the
out your
thi-
orientation
wait a minute.
To
wait,
those.
Wait, excuse me, just
I'm
one
just
second.
To find out
all of
do
those
about
things
Mr.
that you mentioned are very recent.
Putin testing you, do you believe, sir?
No, I don't think so. I think Putin probably assumes that he can't make a deal with me anymore because politically it would be unpopular for a politician to make a deal. I can't believe I'm saying I'm a politician, but I guess that's what I am now. Because, look, it would be much easier for me to be tough on Russia, but then we're not going to make a deal. Now, I don't know that we're going to make a deal. I don't know. We might not. But it would be much easier for me to be so tough. The tougher I am on Russia, the better. But you know what? I want to do the right thing for the American people. And to be honest, secondarily, I want to do the right thing for the world. If Russia and the United States actually got together and got along, and don't forget, we're a very powerful nuclear country, and so are they. There's no upside. We're a very powerful nuclear country. And so are they. I've been briefed, and I can tell you one thing about a briefing that we're allowed to say because anybody that ever read the most basic book can say it. Nuclear Holocaust would be like no other. They're a very powerful nuclear country, and so are we. If we have a good relationship with Russia, believe me, that's a good thing.
For more on U.S.-Russia relations and the Trump administration, we spoke with analyst and senior lecturer at Moscow State University, Mark Sloboda.
We have seen the first figure of the Trump administration hauled in front of the witch trials and thrown on the bonfire.
Right.
And his head decapitated, cut off the body for good measure. And nominally, the person's doing this is not about the courts. There was never any real possibility from what we know so far of Trump, of Flynn appearing in a court. The Logan Act is a 200-year old statute that has never been used for a prosecution. And it is the fact that it is even being referenced is so hypocritical and cynical. If you want to talk about real violations of the Logan Act, Obama, still as a private citizen, was transiting all around the world in 2008 during the election campaign, having all kinds of communication with foreign officials and so on, as were his whole array of aides, associates, and future cabinet members, including particularly Michael McFaul, who would become his ambassador to Russia. So the idea that Flynn is somehow singularly guilty of this old statute that everyone ignores, and with good reason, is nonsense.
The Logan Act was actually implemented, directed at someone who had successfully avoided war for the United States with France, tamped down what they called the quasi-war, and made peace. In other words, they made this law so that would never happen again, that a private citizen could help the United States avoid a war.
Yeah. And Flynn was not a private citizen. He was
right.
Part of the incoming administration.
That's right.
He was just, 2 to 3 weeks from taking office. He was the national security advisor, as the vice president, Pence himself, argued on the Sunday talk shows. Flynn was doing exactly what the national security advisor is supposed to do.
That's right.
All right. And the question is being raised that he had inappropriate communications with the Russian ambassador.
Right.
Inappropriate. If he had other conversations he had with other foreign officials are going completely unremarked on, unnoticed, Netanyahu and everyone else. The fact is that he had communications with the Russian ambassador and that the communications were not hostile, as in not rabidly anti-Russian. Right. I would never characterize Flynn or even Trump as pro-Russian. But the new definition of pro-Russian or pro-Putin or Putin apologist is simply that you are not rabidly enough anti-Russian. That right. That is the context we're dealing with here. The heresy that he committed, the heresy against the U.S. foreign policy establishment and exceptionalist ideology, is that he had a non-accusatory conversation with Russia, with a Russian official. That is it. That is it. There was communication and outreach of a positive nature to Russia. That is enough to get this neo-McCarthyite hysteria going. And this is what actually tripped up Flynn and the Trump administration, dealing it a severe mortal blow at this point, is this neo-McCarthyite atmosphere and hysteria that has been whipped up such that Flynn felt that he had to publicly at least lie about these sanctions. I don't particularly buy the argument that he didn't remember that he did discuss the sanctions.
Right.
Evidently, according to anonymous officials reported through the media's discussion of transcripts that they supposedly saw, all he did was simply say that Russia shouldn't overreact to the sanctions.
Right, and here's the fruit of that. You have, first of all, in terms of context, you have a presidential election, and for the first time, going back at least to Reagan and maybe back to 1917, you have a diversity of opinion about how to deal with Russia. Where Trump was saying, let's try to get along with them and work against terrorism and other common goals. And you had Clinton with this rabid McCarthyite, let's get tougher and tougher with Putin, which, ultimately leads to World War III. There's an election. Trump wins the election. And
on
so,
that foreign policy platform.
Exactly. There are many people that voted for
improving relations with Russia. That was explicit. One of the dominant features of his foreign policy, consistent all through the campaign, that did him no particular favors with his own party or the public, but it was out there, and he was elected on that.
And that's right. And as a matter of fact, it ended up framing the entire campaign, because essentially the accusations from the Clinton campaign were centered on exactly that point. Then, after the election, rather than heeding the public's opinion on this issue, Obama doubles down, kicks out the 35 diplomats, imposes more sanctions. And I remember the day that early in the day, Foreign Minister Lavrov says, look, when these things happen, the proper response is to respond in kind, and that's what I'm going to advise President Putin to do. And somehow, suddenly, by the end of the day, President Putin says, you know what, we're not going to get all bent out of shape over this. Not only are we not going to reciprocate in kind, rather, I'm inviting all of these people and their families to my house for the holidays.
For New Year's.
Right, okay. And so you have basically a de-escalation of this crisis that was provoked by Obama in the face of the vote on November 8th. And that is what he stands accused of doing in terms of interfering in U.S. foreign policy.
Yeah, so there's no legitimacy whatsoever to any accusations of violating the Logan Act. The real accusation is that they wanted and they had outreach to improve foreign relations with Russia. And in this neo-McCarthyite atmosphere and hysteria, Flynn, for whatever reason, felt that he had to publicly lie that he didn't discuss the sanctions. This was his fatal flaw. Again, not that in itself is illegal. He testified to no one under any oath, right, or to that regard. He wasn't in a court like, say, Clinton lying about her servers or something like this.
Or did not have sexual relations with that woman.
Yeah. He simply lied in the court of a public opinion. And if that was a removal and beheading offense, well, then there wouldn't be any politicians.
Yeah. Washington would be depopulated. Yeah, really.
whatsoever. But it has further incited the media's attacks to a fever pitch level. And it seems that Trump felt he had to remove the cause of this hysteria, and I think it's extremely misplaced. Blood on the water will only increase the feeding frenzy.
That's right.
He's shown weakness, and I think it will backfire entirely. Will only increase rather than decrease the calls against this anti-Russian furor against the administration. But while this is out in front, and there's no question they play a huge part in it, the media, this is actually someone else acting in their stead. This is the deep state. This is the foreign policy blob. These were the sources, the anonymous sources that the Washington Post, nine anonymous former and current officials, and the New York Times also. Everyone has got anonymous sources. My anonymous sources say that your anonymous former and current official sources are full of shit, and so on. This is absolute. This is the way we're governing now, by these anonymous sources. Now, in all of this, the only one who committed any legal offense and a serious felony is these nine former and current officials and a few others in other sources that told this to the Washington Post. That is the absolute truth. And we know how much the Obama administration liked whistleblowers that were having leaks during his administration. He prosecuted more whistleblowers than every other president before him, and perhaps more than all of them combined. But suddenly, Democrats are now in love with leaks and whistleblowers again.
Oh yeah, after Obama,
because it's defending their political position and covering up for the defeat of Clinton and all of this.
Yeah, an interesting tweet from Trump on this point. There were a series of them today, but this one, thank you to Eli Lake of the Bloomberg View, and he puts in quotes, I guess this is from Lake, the NSA and FBI should not interfere in our politics and is. And that's the quote. Very serious situation for USA. And then he says, the real scandal here is that classified information is illegally given out by intelligence like candy. Very un-American.
Yeah. This is, when we're talking these figures, Eli Lake, David Ignatius, we have to understand that these so-called national security correspondents, they are the mouthpieces of the deep state. When they are trotted out with anonymous officials and sources, this is the deep state speaking, and they are the ones who have committed this decapitation against Flynn. Flynn was not particularly popular in the Trump cabinet. It hasn't gelled yet. They've just a motley group of individuals, not altogether too different from the normal situation that they have, pecking right and hierarchy, disagreements among them. All cabinets have those. But he was not particularly liked by the establishment figures, and in particularly Mattis, who is the defense secretary, Kelly, as the director of national intelligence, and others didn't like Flynn. Now, we have to remember that Flynn was actually the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency under Obama. Up until the very end, where he was then removed under some sign of displeasure, personal displeasure from Obama, not any official misconduct. So there wasn't a lot of people with establishment power in the Trump administration sticking out their necks for Flynn to protect him in this case. Right. And they might have used him as a lightning rod, again, I think mistakenly. But Flynn, no, let's be honest about Flynn's. I have actually met the man, actually when he was here in Russia with RT, right. One of the things that has caused so much fury from Democrats. I briefly spoke to him and asked him why the U.S. Was backing al-Qaeda in Syria.
Right.
And Flynn is a terrible anti-Iranian hawk. No question about that. Flynn, I don't think that describing him as an Islamophobe is entirely off base either. Neither one of these are characteristics that I find, something I necessarily want in a national security advisor. But he was a, shall we say, the only revolutionary figure in Trump's cabinet with establishment credentials, in that he came up out of the military and was former director of the Defense Intelligence Agency and so on. He planned, he wanted to work towards a critical and major restructuring of the intelligence agencies and the intelligence community, the way they collect data, the way they present it to the president, which was changed under Obama. And the deep state felt this as a threat. He also proposed some radical foreign policy moves that angered the blob, the foreign policy establishment. And one of those, of course, was that he didn't hate Russia. He, on multiple occasions, he had non-complimentary things to say about Russia. He was critical of it in any way, in all the ways that a defense intelligence head should be. But he didn't ideologically, rabidly, partisanly hate Russia. He saw them as a great power that the U.S. had to deal with and could at times deal with competitively and at times deal with cooperatively. But that itself is a heresy right there, because you can't ever cooperate with Russia, according to the dominant establishment blob mood right now. So with Flynn gone, the ability of the Trump administration to restructure the intelligence community and to enact any kind of serious changes in foreign policy away from hegemonic control, away from regime changes towards détente with Russia, is severely crippled. And when I first heard that Flynn, resigned, I was torn. I said, is this net a good thing, i.e., particularly on Iran and so on, or is this a bad thing with regards to Russia, or Flynn was also an opponent of the U.S. Backing of sectarian militants allied with al-Qaeda in Syria? And in the end, I have to come down on the side that it is a bad thing. We cannot expect to see radical revolutionary change within the Trump administration on intelligence and security or foreign policy right now, because the only ones remaining who are proponents of that, I would say Bannon and Stephen Miller, are not themselves establishment figures. They have no power bases of their own. They're just Trump's advisors and creatures, as it were, while Mattis, Kellogg, the others, even Tillerson, whose primary interest you have to probably bet comes down on the side of oil, big energy, with which is part of the establishment itself. So I see Flynn as we don't have to love everything about the man or his politics to consider that this is radically, this has wounded the Trump administration's ability to enact any type of radical change in directions that we might want to see a change. And it's not going to stop the rest of the Trump administration from promoting war with Iran or any decrease in their Islamophobia, as we have plenty of other officials in the administration, Pompeo, Mattis, who are also Islamophobic or anti-Iranian or both. So I don't think that the left really gains from the international real left gains from seeing Flynn's departure in any way.
So, with the loss of connection to some of the institutional power that Flynn represented. You have Trump. He's looking at, well, for, you know, the context is, let's look at foreign policy last week. It runs a piece called Three Ways to Remove Trump, and they actually listed four, the fourth being a military coup.
Yeah, that was Rosa Brooks at Foreign Policy.
Yeah, one of the things that Trump can do without Congress is remove people both within the military and also in various other institutions of power from their positions. Now, replacing them, unfortunately for him, does involve Congress in many cases. And so as you look at perhaps purging the military of some of these, you know, maniac hawks or the State Department or whatever, until you can place your people in there, which it will be a struggle and compromise involved, you have to live with the people who are in line to be the acting this or the acting that. What's the landscape look like for that? You know, because I know you have some expertise in this, and I know also you don't have a list, of course, of the personnel records of any of these places.
Yeah, well, the National Security Advisor doesn't, that's the one position that doesn't have to be approved in the cabinet, approved by Congress. That's at the president's discretion, as long as they meet basic, you know, security checks and so on. That's the reason why Flynn was given that position, because he was already vulnerable from having the committing the heresy of visiting Russia and speaking to RT once as a private citizen. And in between, after he was left as head of the Defense Intelligence Agency under Obama.
So I guess I could never have that job.
Yeah. So that's not a question. There's several people on Trump's shortlist. I've heard Petraeus mentioned, which would be astounding because he's committed far greater real offenses
than
Flynn
offenses,
ever committed.
Right. Yeah, right.
When he leaked classified information to his mistress, who was a journalist in Afghanistan. Kellogg is the deputy national security advisor who will be the acting national security advisor until a replacement is chosen. I've seen several other names, most of them generals being put forward, but none of them are the radical type of figures that Flynn would have been in the position. What comes out of this not only is the removal of Flynn and his influence in the cabinet, but also the calls are already coming to go forward, right, from the Democrats, from the neocons, calling for independent investigations, not only into Flynn, but into any Trump advisor and campaign relations with Russia. And that is the inquisitional vehicle that could be used to bring the Trump administration down. Right now, that could only happen if the Republicans agree to it, both the Republican establishment in the House and the Senate, both in having an investigation actually put into place and in any end impeachment that would theoretically result out of that. And that will be used as leverage by the Republican establishment now, particularly McConnell in the Senate and Ryan in the House, Speaker Ryan in the House, that if Trump continues to push too radically on foreign policy or other controversial measures, that they will release these hounds, witch trials on Trump, so that he had better get in line. And they'll allow him to proceed with the aspects of his domestic agenda that they do agree with. So they've got a huge leverage over President Trump now. And we've already seen, I think, some indication of that, as we saw the Trump spokesman Spicer the last 24 hours come out, and while Trump had suggested in the campaign that he might under certain conditions, be willing to recognize Crimea as part of Russia. Spicer suddenly said it's part of Trump's demands that Russia somehow return Crimea to Ukraine, or at least to the the West-backed Putsch regime in Ukraine. To which my Crimean wife poked up her head and said, "He said what?" Right. Over my dead body.
And all those people that voted, by the way, in the referendum.
Yes. Yeah, some 96, 97% of the Crimean population.
Right.
Of course, that's not possible. Russia wouldn't allow it. The Crimean people wouldn't accept it. In fact, right now, one of the things my wife from the Crimea, from Simferopol, often says is Russia didn't annex us. We annexed Moscow.
That's right.
Because in many ways, the Crimean people are more pro-Russian patriotic than a good 30% of the population of Moscow is, including a few officials still in the Kremlin.
That's right. Looking at all of this, particularly this apparent... I don't know if it's really a change in policy or, rhetorical sop to the Republicans in the Senate and House. But if in fact it means that there's going to be at least ambiguity on the point of improving relations with Russia, the deployment of all the forces to Russia's borders, the incidents that they keep trying to provoke in places like the Black Sea and elsewhere.
The Baltics.
Yeah. With all of that and the aggressive posture that Poroshenko's been taking again. I was speaking with Mikhail Portis in Donetsk earlier today and last week. And, the shelling of Donetsk center, taking out apartment buildings and such with ballistic missiles. It's definitely a step up in activity. What do you think? Where is all of this going to lead?
Yeah, I'm not so worried about the placement of NATO troops, not as worried, on Russia's borders. These are relatively small amount of troops. They are there for political reassurance and human tripwires against a conditions that will never occur. Russia has no intention of taking the Baltics. In fact, many of the people in Russia consider that was one of the good things about the Soviet Union collapsing, is they finally got rid of the Baltics and the West can have their fill of them. Waffen-SS celebration parades and all. Russia has no intention of invading or taking over the Baltics. The only condition where Russia would take military action against the Baltics is where a conventional war between the U.S. and between NATO and Russia has already begun elsewhere, like, say, in the Ukraine or elsewhere, that it is obviously spreading to a general level of war. And Russia would then have to take the Baltics to prevent it being used as a landing bridge to put troops, funnel NATO troops and tanks and so on straight into St. Petersburg. That is the only condition where the Baltics would be invaded, as if a general conventional war had already started. Because other than that, they're simply not worth the obvious problem that they would be for an occupation. I mean, yeah, sure, some 30 to 40% of the population of much of the Baltics is Russian ethnic. That doesn't even mean they're all necessarily pro-Russian government.
Right.
And the rest of the population obviously wouldn't enjoy it. They're anti-Russian. Russia has plenty of territory and enough people. It doesn't need to occupy people who don't want it there. If you look closely, wherever Russia has put troops in the former Soviet Union, whether in Ossetia and Abkhazia, in Georgia, or in Donbass, or the Crimea, or even when it sent troops in the civil war in Tajikistan early on in the 90s, those are all places where the local population wants Russian troops. Right. And there are political problems in those countries, most of them exacerbated or directly incited by the West. So Russia doesn't need to take territory or peoples that don't want to be part of Russia. Its problem is turning away people that do want to be part of Russia, such as in Transnistria, that Russia can't politically accept because of geopolitical reasons.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.